So this morning we are going to talk about Patanjali, and among other things we're going to cover the Eightfold Path, which is what is, it isn't embroidered, what is it? Stitched on? Anyway. Applique on. So we're going to applique on ourselves the Eightfold Path. This is a great subject this morning. This is wonderful. You know, when Howard Carter, he was the man who discovered the tomb of King Tut, and the first thing they did was they knocked a little hole in the wall so he could look in to see what was in there. And there was just silence, maybe for a minute or so, and everybody was anxious. And then somebody said, "What do you see? What do you see?" And he said, "Wonderful things." So by the end of today's class, I hope you're going to say, "What did you see with Patanjali?" Wonderful things. Because Patanjali, I mentioned yesterday that of the three scriptures that we're studying, fourth will be, of course, the autobiography. But the Gita and the Bible are widely, widely read and widely influences whole cultures, the whole world culture. But Patanjali doesn't so much. Patanjali is meant for a more narrow audience. And in fact, it's meant for the audience that is comprised of us. His very, very first statement in the Yoga Sutras is, "And now we come to the study of the science of yoga." And that Master talked a lot about, in fact, Master said that when he was with Sri Yukteswar, they studied that "and now" for about 6 months, because it implies everything that comes before the study of the science of yoga. So we have a couple of hundred people here and another 100 or 200 attending online. And there are a few million people in the world who are seriously studying yoga of the type, I don't mean just the postures, which I won't go into that, because I will go into it. I don't want to leave it hanging there. Generally speaking, the postures as they're presented in America, in the West, are not presented as the means to achieve yoga or the means to achieve union with God. They're presented as a physical system. And that's why Swami wanted Ananda Yoga to be presented as the system, as a system that used not only the body, because the body is important, but also the mind and the soul, combining with that to move energy to help us achieve union with God. So the first statement of Patanjali is, "And now we come to the study of the science of yoga." But having said that, that most people are not yet interested, it takes lots and lots and lots of incarnations before we want to be free from this world. It's a giant Disneyland. And Master said that God, being the dramatist that he is, makes it very entrancing, very enjoyable, but not just enjoyable. It's the ups and downs, and you're up one day, you're down the next. It's very exciting. It's like the roller coaster, you know. It's exciting, it's frightening, it's exhilarating, it's terrifying, it's all of those things together. But when you're on it, you aren't thinking of much else. There are maybe a few who are thinking of, "Let me get off of here." And out of those few, a very, very few, saying, "Let me get out of this theme park." And it's only those who are ready to study the science of yoga, because Patanjali especially shows us where the exit door is. And until we're ready for that exit door, we aren't interested. And so, as well as that, the "and now" implies the study. There are other systems of, we can't say philosophy. Philosophy is the love of knowledge, but of revealed wisdom. And so Vedas and Vedanta is one, and Shankhya philosophy is another. Shankhya shows that this world is never going to be fulfilling. Vedanta shows where we're trying to get to, what is God. And yoga shows how we get there. So the yoga is the how to achieve what we're after. And so until we're ready to achieve liberation or moksha or exit the theme park, we're not interested in the how, nor are we particularly interested in where the exit door is. We've got a big roll of tickets. Free rides. As much food as you want. Everything's free in this theme park. And if you run out of that roll of tickets, you just go and you get another big roll. You reincarnate. And so you, as long as you're wanting that, you keep reincarnating. It's the desires, the likes and the dislikes, which Master goes into in depth. But it's the likes and dislikes that keep this ride entrancing. And as long as there remains any desires, the way it's set up is if you have a desire, that desire has to be fulfilled. And so if you have a desire or an aversion that requires being on the physical plane, then your soul will reincarnate back on the physical plane. And so that's, you know, the never-ending roll of tickets until Master says that it takes on an anguishing monotony. And when the soul has experienced enough so that the world takes on, it's not bad, it's not terrible, it's just, oh, not the roller coaster again. Not teenage high school years again. Not the diapers again. Until it takes on an anguishing monotony. And the soul, which is our true self, perceives that continuing. See, the ego doesn't remember from lifetime to lifetime, but the soul remembers, and finally it's the soul, our true self, that wants to get free. And so when that takes place, then we come to, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga. The next one, and this is wonderful, this is the heart of the heart. This defines the problem and why we're stuck here. The second one is yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the neutralization of chitta, or the master described this, defined it as the primordial feeling nature that we have. And so yoga is the neutralization of the feeling nature, primordial feeling nature, and that resides in the heart area, in the chakra of the heart area. That's where chitta is. And this should sound somewhat familiar to us from this week. Does anybody see the connection? We ended yesterday with Jesus telling us, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." That's almost a direct translation of yoga is for those who are pure in heart and have neutralized the likes and dislikes. So blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Virtually the same statement. Now, Master talked about quite a bit about it was that chitta, I'll come to the vrittis in a minute. Chitta is primordial feeling. And he said that other translations often get it wrong. It's sometimes translated as yoga is the neutralization of mind stuff. Apart from the fact that what the heck does they mean by mind stuff, Master said that that's wrong. That minds, the mind, our consciousness, our conscious functioning, has four aspects to it. It has, first of all, it has what's called mon, or the perceptive element, that which we simply perceive. So think of a television set. The television set has gets the signals, perceives it, and presents the picture. But the television set has no idea what's on the screen because it's got no intelligence, but it has the perceptive element. So the perceptive element, that's mon. The ability to perceive what's on that screen is buddhi. And there are some fascinating connections coming up here. Believe me, folks, we're in for a good ride this time. And so that's that you look on the television set, and let's say that it's not a program that's out there. It's actually a kind of a security camera, and it's looking out into your property. And so the screen doesn't understand anything, but you look and you see a pasture, and you see your horse out in the pasture. And so you identify the intelligence, buddhi, identifies that's a pasture, that's a fence, the grass is green, that's a horse, the horse is white, the horse is all of those things. So buddhi understands and identifies those things. But that still doesn't get us stuck. Then ego comes in and says, that's my property. That fence denotes my property, that's my horse, and that's my grass, and so that's at play. These things play all the time. If somebody got up and went out to, I don't know, get a shawl and came back, and somebody was sitting in the chair that they just left, they'd say, that's my chair. It's not your chair, obviously, but it's your chair for a little while. But see, that's ego. That's ahankara comes in and says, that's mine. And Master said, we're still not stuck. It's when we say, oh, I love my horse. I want my chair. I don't like that person sitting in my chair. I don't like the neighbor on the other side of the fence. It's the likes and dislikes that grab us and get us stuck. Now, I said there were some connections here with other scriptures. Who represents mon? Mon, by the way, Master said, is kind of the top of the head, or one could say kind of in the middle of the brain also. Who represents that? Because they can't discriminate? Dhritarashtra, the head of the Kauravas, the king of the Kauravas, represents the blind mind. Who represents discrimination? Pandu, King Pandu. The Pandavas represent the ability to discriminate. Who represents ego? Bhishma. Remember, Bhishma couldn't be killed? We didn't go into the whole story. Devi touched on it. But at the end of the Gita, at the end of the war, Bhishma has been riddled with arrows, so many arrows in him, that you can't put two fingers between any two arrows. And he's laying on a bed of arrows. He's still not dead. And he doesn't die for quite a long time after the battle because he's instructing Yudhishthira, who now is the king of the kingdom, he's instructing him in how to properly rule a kingdom. And only when he wills, only when the ego wills to give up, do we have the end of the ego. And so those three characters represent, you know, mon, buddhi, ahankara, and then chitta is in the heart, and that's primordial feelings. That's the likes and the dislikes. And it's described And vrittis means whirlpools, little vortexes of energy. You know, whirlpools is a kind of a visual image, but in today's world, we might say that vrittis represent the little magnetic impulses that are on the hard drive. And that hard drive, now we have multi-terabits of hard drives, so you have hard drives that easily hold all the books in the Library of Congress, and just a tiny portion of them. Well, our hard drive holds all of our past memories, all of our past experiences, all of our past feelings. We're going to come to the point where hard drives are not hard drives anymore. In fact, we're already at that point. There is a scientist from Harvard who is one of the leading people working with kind of the ability to edit DNA. And so a few years ago, somebody sent him a paper for peer review. And he decided that he wrote a little article, but he decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to encode my article in the letters that make up DNA. And so I'll have each letter stand for a particular little sequence of DNA. And so he encoded this, sent it back. Nobody knew what in the heck they had received. And he had a little fun with it. But then he wrote a book, a 250-page book. And he said, you know what? I could encode that the same way I encoded that little article. And you know what further I could do? I could take a gene editing machine and I could create artificial DNA that encoded my book. And so he did that. And so in a drop from an eyedropper, he encoded about 150 billion copies of his book in the DNA, artificial DNA. And so now people have realized that this is a way that we can do hard drive storage. And so they take that artificial DNA and they put it into a glass capsule, and it can last for 100,000 years. Well, ours can last for infinity. So our memory, not literally in DNA, because the memory is beyond that, but DNA is just an expression of the hard drive system. Anyway, I don't want to go on with this because we have so much to cover this morning. But here we're talking about the little vortexes of energy and how all of those vortexes are encoding the likes and dislikes, especially of what we have lived through before and our particular patterns. And so Patanjali is saying that in order to achieve union with God, we have to neutralize all that stuff. We have to end it. We have those little vortexes of energy need to be neutralized. And so all of those likes and dislikes need to be neutralized. So now I'm going to do some reading this morning, because Patanjali, well, first of all, this 7 pages or so is the whole of Patanjali. You can read the Yoga Sutras in less than a half hour. And we're going to make this. This is from Swami's book. Devi is going to do the show and tell. This is Swami's book, Demystifying Patanjali. And so I took the sutra itself without the explanation, and I just made a list of them. So we'll make this available. Everybody that's registered, we'll just send it out to you. For you in the community, you can, I don't know, contact Krishnadas. We'll put the burden on him. Or maybe we'll figure out an easier way that this will be available, and you can just download it. But
whoever gets the villager in the community.
Yeah. Get a link. So I'm going to read a few sections, because here in this first section now, we're talking about the root of the problem. Why aren't we automatically here in samadhi, in union with God? Well, it's because we have not yet neutralized the vrittis. And so Patanjali says, yoga is the neutralization of the vortices of feeling. Then, spiritually free, the sage, or we, abides in his inner self. Otherwise, if one hasn't neutralized those, the vrittis cause the indwelling self to assume many outward forms. So these vrittis cause us to assume reincarnation after reincarnation after reincarnation. And again, what are the vrittis? Swami, they're little whirlpools of likes and dislikes, but Swami defines them as they're all of the inclinations, the desires, the attachments that we have formed. Remember, he called the ego or defined the ego as a bundle of self-definitions. The vrittis are all those self-definitions, but not just self-definitions in a calm way, self-definitions that we are either attached to or want to overcome. Likes and dislikes get us caught in that. And so if we have neutralized that, the soul sits in its own inner self. And if we haven't, that soul, because of those vrittis, reincarnates over and over and over again until we do neutralize them. It's as simple as that, as simple and as hard as that. There are five classifications of vrittis, some painful and others painless. The vrittis are right and wrong conceptions of what is, imagination, sleep, and memory. So these are the ways the mind functions because of those vrittis. And it's what keeps us caught in this world. And so that's the root of the problem and the essence of how we get out of it. So Patanjali in I don't know, 150 words here, less than that, 100 words, has defined the problem and told us the results of what happens if we don't work with this. The rest of the Yoga Sutras are going to follow from this, because what follows from that is to further define what these things are, also show us primarily, and this is the importance of it, he is going to show us the way out. So Patanjali gives us a little map that says, in the theme park that you're in, if you want to get out, here's where the exit is. And those people who go over, there's just a stack of maps, there's a stack of Patanjali books. Those few people who want out go over and they pick up Demystifying Patanjali. And they start looking at that roadmap or that map of how to get out of here. Okay, so then, now the next section, I mean, I could read this, but I'm not going to read all of it. It would get too long. The next section is talking about calming the vrittis. How do we calm those vrittis? How do we neutralize them? He said, the vrittis are calmed by practice and non-attachment. Practice and non-attachment. Remember, they're the likes and dislikes. So if we achieve distancing ourselves from those likes and dislikes, then we achieve the calming of the vrittis. Master, for years and years, like 15 or more years, on Sundays when he was free and he was at Mount Washington, in the afternoons on Sundays, he would have a little group of disciples come and he would talk about Patanjali. And so he gave about 45 of these little talks, little lectures on Patanjali. And those were transcribed. Unfortunately, we don't have copyrights to them, so we can't take them and release them to the world. It would be wonderful if we could. But in those, I was reading through and I was trying to put titles to each of these 45 different lectures. And I ended up having about 10 or 15 of the titles talk about non-attachment. Because over and over again, see, that's what a lot of the stuff that Patanjali talks about, he's going to talk about when you're in the state of samyama or the state of samadhi, what the powers are, what you can do. And if you're in the state of samadhi and if you concentrate on an elephant, then you draw the strength of the elephant. If you concentrate on clouds or the air, then you levitate and so on. Well, a lot of that stuff is very interesting, but how pertinent is it to us until we get to that state? So Patanjali, he's showing us wonderful things out there that are waiting for us. But Master concentrated more on those things that we can do. We can work on our attachments. We can work on non-attachment. We can work on distancing ourselves from our likes and dislikes. And he talked over and over about how that's needed for us to do in order to achieve these things. So I'll just read a few. So close your eyes. I'm going to read through a few of these. The vrittis are calmed by practice and by non-attachment. The endeavor to develop even-mindedness is what constitutes spiritual practice. Spiritual practice becomes firmly grounded when it is undertaken for a long time without break and with deep earnestness. From constant self-remembrance, there comes complete non-attachment to things seen or heard. When one ceases to thirst for outward manifestation, having realize the Purusha, the soul, one attains supreme non-attachment. Yogis who have not attained the highest state by the time they die remain attached to nature owing to the ego's continued identification with outwardness. For others, that highest state is attained through faith, strength of will, mindfulness, conditioned oneness, and discrimination. With keen and one-pointed practice, this highest attainment comes easily. The time required for success depends also on whether one's practice is mild, medium, or intense. Otherwise, through devotion and complete self-offering to God, this highest samadhi is attained. Okay, so here he's talking about what we have to do in order to calm these vrittis, in order to neutralize them and achieve freedom from them. And so primarily it is the practice of non-attachment. But the mind itself cannot detach itself from these. The heart energy, the citta, cannot detach itself because its very nature is this feeling nature. And so what we have to do is withdraw our consciousness from the outwardness, withdraw our attachments from the objects of our attachment. So when you have a desire for something, and Swami's talked quite a bit about this, when you have a desire for something, try to discriminate. And he talks about different ways that we can do this. Do I really want this? Do I really need this? Do I have to have this? And it can be plus or minus. Do I have to have this angry concept in my mind about this? Any of our feelings, plus or minus, do you need to have it? Do you have to be attached to it? So by calming ourselves, sometimes we can say, I don't. I don't want it. I don't need it. I really am not interested. And we overcome it. And so there's the little desire comes, or the little blip comes in the mind. And through discrimination, we can say, no thanks. And so that's one way. Kamala Silva, no, it was Gyanamata, who said, we're not responsible or the first thought that comes into our mind. It's like that comes in unbidden. We're responsible for what happens after that first thought. And so you're walking calmly down the road and you see the geese and a desire comes in. I wish those geese weren't here. So you're not even kind of aware. You're just walking along and all of a sudden it pops in your mind. So Gyanamata says, you're not really responsible. You being, in this case, your discriminatory faculties. You're not really responsible for that. But you are responsible if you continue on with that. I hate those geese. They just honk and, you know, they make a mess. And it'd be so. And if you let your mind run away with your desires. So if you catch right away, as you're beginning to have a thought, either of likes or dislikes, and say, I don't need this. That's one means of non-attachment. Now, if you get rolling with it a little bit, to the point where you can't stop it, then another thing that Patanjali says is think of the opposite of that which is there. So in this case, if you're thinking you dislike geese, you think of the opposite. I love everything in nature. I love Divine Mother because Divine Mother has created this beautiful world for me. And so you neutralize it by finding the opposite quality. So that's another way to achieve non-attachment. Swami said, sometimes we're kind of attached to things, but not super attached. And he said, for instance, if you see something beautiful that you want to buy, then, and you can't get over the thought of buying it, then buy it and give it away. And in fact, talking of theme parks and rides and all of that, I was with Swamiji at Epcot Center, which is the Disney Center in Florida we were visiting. And we spent 2 or 3 days there. And he really enjoyed it because he was a world traveler and Epcot is set up around an artificial lake and it's got all these little villages. So you can go from being in Norway and the people there are Norwegians and you look at the Viking things and you can eat fish and all of that. Lutefisk and Lefse, for those of you. I grew up in a Norwegian town. And so then you can go from Norway and you can walk right over to Spain in 30 seconds and then you can walk over to Japan and so on. And you go around the lake and there are all these little villages. Well, and they do demonstrations and so on. In the little area for Japan, there was this beautiful teapot and creamer and sugar container, whatever you call that. And Swami, it was just beautiful. Swami looked at it and he really enjoyed that. So he looked at it and then he said, oh, I don't need to buy that. I have too many of them. And so, but every day for 2 or 3 days, we would stop by and he would look at that. And then finally he said, it's just too beautiful. I have to buy it. So he bought it and had it packed up and shipped. And then a month or so later, he presented that as a present to Devi and me. And so if you ever visit our house, you're likely to get tea. If you have visited our house, you're likely to have gotten tea out of that little teapot. But that was Swamiji practicing how to overcome attachments. If there really is something, he was attached to the beauty of it, not to the ownership of it. If you are, then go ahead and get it, but then expand that consciousness and offer it to someone else. And so these are various ways to overcome our attachments and our likes and our dislikes, but we have to work on that. That is, as Patanjali says, spiritual practice consists of overcoming and becoming even-mindedness. Now, I'm going to read a little section from Master here. This is one of the very first stories that he tells. He was 8 years old. This is on page 11 and 12 in the autobiography, so very early on. He was 8 years old, and he'd gotten sick, remember? And he was sitting, and his mother said, pray, even mentally. He was on his deathbed. Pray mentally to the picture of Lahiri Mahashaya, his mother's guru. And then a great light came out of that, and Master was quickly healed. So 8 years old. Then he says, shortly after my healing, through the potency of the guru's picture, I had an influential spiritual vision. Sitting on my bed one morning, I fell into a deep reverie. What is behind the darkness of closed eyes? This probing thought came powerfully into my mind. An immense flash of light at once manifested to my inward gaze. Divine shapes of saints sitting in meditation posture in mountain caves formed like a miniature cinema pictures on the large screen of radiance within my forehead. Who are you? I spoke aloud. We are the Himalayan yogis. The celestial response is difficult to describe. My heart was thrilled. Ah, I longed to go to the Himalayas and become like you. The vision vanished, but the silvery beams expanded in ever-widening circles to infinity. What is this wondrous glow? I am Ishwara. I am light. The voice was as murmuring clouds. I want to be one with thee. Out of the slow dwindling of my divine ecstasy, I salvaged a permanent legacy of inspiration to seek God. He is eternal, ever new joy. This memory persisted long after the day of rapture. So that's this beautiful message from an 8-year-old master avatar that he has written for our benefit. But right after where I'm reading now, I'm still on the first page. We haven't even gotten to the 33 on one page. We're at like 20. So Patanjali takes up that theme. And he says, with keen, one-pointed practice, this highest attainment comes. The time required for success depends on whether one's practice is mild, medium, or intense. Otherwise, through devotion, complete self-offering to God, comes this highest attainment. Then, Ishwara, same Ishwara here, is the Supreme Self, unaffected by any affliction, karma, action, or consequence thereof, or impression of desires, free of impression of desires. In him is fully developed the seed of omniscience. Unconditioned by time, he is the supreme instructor of even the most ancient teachers, the old Himalayan yogis. The expression of Ishwara is hidden in the sound of Om. To repeat it truly in deep meditation, to listen and become absorbed in it, reveals its true meaning. Through meditation on the inner sound of Om, one gains the power to overcome obstacles and to realize oneness with the inner self. So Om, and then he's going to go on, Ishwara reveals himself through Om. That's our inner self, our true inner self is revealed through Om and through the light, looking into the light. And so these are two primary practices, primary techniques of this path, the Om technique and listening to that Om and looking into the light, especially after the practice of Kriya Yoga or are there techniques. Master said, looking into that light will change the very cells of your brain. Looking in, connecting to Ishwara after the outer techniques of meditation will change you inwardly in ways that you don't even know. I'm, I guess, particularly drawn to looking into the light. And I think that's why Swamiji gave me the name. Jyotish means, Jyoti is light, and Ish is Ishwara. So it's the light of Ishwara. It's the inner light. And that's the meaning of the name that Swami gave me. But to depersonalize it, for any of us, that deep practice, which is absolutely central to our spiritual path, one could say even more central than the practice of Kriya Yoga, because Kriya Yoga is meant, and Devi will talk about this, to get the mind calm enough so that we can be one with that inner light, or at least be able to, without restlessness, be able to look into it. And so Patanjali and Master, you know, you read this story of Masters and it seems, oh, isn't that sweet? I wish that would have happened to me. But Master is, all of this is connected together in very deep and very subtle ways. And so that appearance of Ishwara and Master talking about it and how the permanent legacy of the desire to seek God came from that, he's telling us, you too sit down and try to see what's behind your closed eyes and try to see the light to the best of our ability. So now I want to talk a little bit about overcoming the ego. And I'm still on the first page. What I would suggest, and I can't suggest it strongly enough, is when you get this, sit down and read through it. Even if we don't understand the depth of what's here, simply reading through it shows us wonderful things. It shows us who we really are, because we're caught in the little prison of the ego. We have no idea what awaits us and who we will become. But even reading through this for 15 minutes expands our consciousness, and at least we have the glimmers and the hope and a roadmap of where to get there. Yes, the journey still has to be undertaken, but how valuable it is to know where we're going and how to get there. Okay, this is overcoming. Through meditation on the inner sound of Om, one gains the power to overcome all obstacles and to realize his oneness with the inner self. Disease, dullness, doubt, carelessness, laziness, sensuality, false perception, missing the point, instability, and backsliding. These are the obstacles. In another sense, he's just talking about who the Kauravas are. These are qualities of the Kauravas, qualities of the downward pulling energy. And they are the obstacles. And what do? We have to fight against those obstacles. And I'm going to come later on and talk about who's on our side, but those are the obstacles. Accompanying the obstacles are moodiness. Anybody have any moodiness? Despair. Nervous agitation. And agitated breathing. So you go and you spend time with the Kauravas, those downward pulling tendencies, the obstacles, and you can spend time there, but you're going to be in despair, you're going to be nervous, agitated breathing, and moody as a result of that. And so all of that, if we've done that in the past, we have those little vrittis that draw us to be moody. And it's one of the ways that we enjoy the roller coaster. If we're still wanting to be on the roller coaster, we go up and down and up and down, and we get moody. Or we get in despair, and we wonder why. That's because we've been hanging out with the Kauravas. The practice of one-pointed concentration is the best way to rise above both the obstacles and the disturbances that accompany them. By cultivating attitudes So that's the best way, the practice of one-pointed concentration. Master said, meditation, he defined it, one-pointed concentration on God or on an aspect of God. That's the best way to overcome that. But now he's going to tell us some other ways. By cultivating attitudes of friendliness toward those who are happy, compassion for the unhappy, delight in the virtuous, and disregard for the wicked, the vrittis, or vortices of attachment and desire, remain in undisturbed calmness, so we don't awaken them. The vrittis can also be neutralized by calming and retaining outward the exhalation of the breath. This is Kriya Yoga. Otherwise, concentration on subtle sense perceptions can bring about steadiness of mind. Otherwise, calmness comes by concentrating on supreme, ever-blissful light within. Otherwise, by the attunement of the mind with an enlightened being, one who is completely free from all attachments and senses. Master talked half the time to his disciples about attunement, attunement being the way out. Otherwise, by concentration on some insight achieved during dreams or deep sleep. Otherwise, also by meditating on anything one finds elevating to his consciousness. So these are the ways, different ways to overcome the pull of those vrittis. And so all of these are part of our spiritual practice. Now I want to end with just a little bit of talking about the section that both Swami and Master used most of the time to talk about, and that's the Eightfold Path. Most of the time they talked about this as a way of showing us the clear roadmap out. And so I'll read what Patanjali says on the Eightfold Path. By practice of one's of the several limbs of yoga, impurities disappear and the light of pure wisdom and discrimination dawns. The eight limbs of yoga are yama, niyama, that's self-denial and observances, three, posture, four, withdrawal of the energy, five, interiorization of the mind, six, concentration, meditation, and absorption. That's yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Those are the Sanskrit names. So I'll just touch on the first two, because the first two are important. Remember I said that I would mention who our allies are on this, on the journey? The allies are the Pandavas. If we're fighting against the Kauravas, the Pandavas are who we need to have on our side, right? Yama is one of the Pandava brothers. That's Sahadev. Master interprets it this way. And also Sahadev brings with him the power of Yama, and that's the power to avoid doing that self-control or self-containment, to avoid doing those things that we shouldn't do. Now Patanjali names five of them, but remember the Kaurava brothers are 100. Patanjali says non-violence, non-lying, non-stealing, non-sensuality, and non-greed. And so he names those five. But don't think that you can just memorize those and say, oh, now I know Patanjali. We have to get to the point where we actually practice those. And likewise, the niyamas represent the second of the Pandava brothers. That's Nakula. And Nakula represents the ability to do that which we should do, which is good for us. So yama, niyama and yama is control and non-control. Yama is niyama means non-control or allowing that to go. Cleanliness, contentment, austerity, self-study, and devotion to God. Those are the ones Patanjali names, but any of the good qualities, any of the things that are good for us are those. And then Patanjali says, and these must be practiced without constraint as to time and circumstances. So we have to do that without. Then Devi's going to talk about asana, pranayama, pratyahara, and then that brings us to the high states, which are called samyama, which are dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. So those are also the Pandava brothers. That's who we have on our side. So the chakras are the energy of these Pandava brothers. And as we get the energy of the chakras moving with us and for us, then we will achieve these higher states. So the third chakra is Arjuna. This is Bhima. This is Yudhishthira. And the high states of meditation, true meditation, once those Pandava brothers help fight for us, then we achieve the high state of Samyama, and that's represented by Krishna. And Krishna is the ultimate goal and the ultimate doer of it all. So you see how these scriptures all work together, all show us the path, show us what's possible. But Patanjali, he shows us wonderful things.
Well, I can't help but share a story about shopping with Swami, which Jyotish brought to mind. Whenever we would go to visit him in India, we wanted to give him a present. We would want to give him a present, but we never knew what he would want. So we would watch when we would go to a store. If he showed particular interest in something, then we would get that for him. And in Gurgaon, where our ashram is, where we have an apartment in India, there's a very nice store called Moe's, and it's a home goods store. And the man, Mr. Moe, is the owner, is an elderly man, and he is, as well as, he's an artist as well. He would design a lot of the beautiful rugs that were for sale there, and everything in there was beautiful, every single object. And Swami liked to go there. And so since Swami passed, we still go to visit Mr. Moe. And Swami became his guru, really. He has a picture of Swami in his office. He says he prays to Swami every day. But one day we were in there with Swami, and there was a beautiful bed covering, a bedspread. It was kind of pearlescent, opalescent, and it had beautiful little flowers embroidered on it. It looked like something from the astral world, and it was spread out on a bed as for display. And we would go, and just as Jyotish was saying about the teapot, Swami would, this was just one visit, but he'd go and he'd look at it, and we would have our little antenna out, and we said, Swami, do you like that? Oh, yes, but I don't need anything more. And then he'd go back. And then finally, the third time when he went back, we said, Swami, can't we buy that for you? And he paused for a moment, and he said, all right, we can't let the Philistines have it. So that was almost worse, more than the bedspread, that little story. So what I'm going to focus on, and my part, and we might go a little long today, we'll stop by noon, but there's just so much to cover for Patanjali. I know Jyotish cut out a lot of what he was going to say to try to make it on time. But what I'm going to be talking about is how Patanjali and the scriptures help us to deepen our meditation and our practice of Kriya. And this part will be a little more experiential. So we've absorbed a lot of heavy philosophy, and now we'll do some little exercises together. But before we get to Patanjali, I want to just touch briefly how the scriptures we've been talking about refer to Kriya. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are two direct references to the practice of Kriya. The one line is, which we hear every week at Sunday service in the Festival of Light, even a little practice, and the way it really is, it says, is of this inward religion will free one from dire fears and colossal suffering. And Master told those who are giving the Kriya initiation, you should quote that sentence in every Kriya initiation because it's about the practice of Kriya. So even a little practice of Kriya will free you from dire fears and colossal suffering. And then in the chapter in the Gita, the supreme science of knowing God, Krishna says, and another practice of yoga is to offer the incoming breath into the outgoing breath, and the outgoing breath into the incoming breath. And by this practice, you will achieve breathlessness. Now, as you know, in the past two classes, and if you weren't able to come, do watch them, because there's so many interconnectedness in what we're saying from one class to the next. They're all recorded and they'll be posted on our website, the Ananda website. But we've been talking about with the Bible and the Gita, the importance of right action. And there's a line in the Gita that says, every person should do their duty, perform right action. It is better to fail at your duty than to succeed at someone else's. So what is our duty? What is our highest duty? For all of us who are Kriya initiates, our highest duty is to practice Kriya Yoga and by extension to experience God. So I look around at all my friends, and I know we're all involved in a myriad of different things, music and cooking and gardening and organizational things and working jobs in the world, whatever it might be. But always remember, as a Kriyaban, your highest duty is to practice Kriya. And everything else should be a support of that. Not, well, I'm going to, you know, succeed at selling books, but then I'll do my Kriya. No, no, no. Succeed at Kriya and then sell books. That's our highest duty. And let's remember that. Let's remind ourselves of that. That is why we came. And yes, we have to do other little things, but that's not our highest duty. Better to succeed at Kriya and fail at the other things. So that is our highest duty, and the Gita is reminding us of that. In the Bible, again, there are no direct references to Kriya, although the great disciple, St. Paul, said, I protest by the Christ within me that I die daily. What does that mean? It means he withdraws the life force through Kriya or a similar practice. Master says in the chapter on Kriya Yoga that Jesus and Elijah, John the Baptist, had a technique, had practiced a technique of Kriya or something very similar. And so these great ones the beauty of it all is there is a roadmap, and you don't get there by detours. You get there by dying daily, by withdrawing the life force. And as we've been saying, all the scriptures have an outer and an inner meaning. And even in that parable from the Bible of the prodigal son, what is that about? The wealthy man's son who gets his inheritance, goes off into the world, squanders it, becomes a hired servant, eating the leftovers from the pigs. And then he realizes, wait a minute, this isn't who I am. And he humbly returns to his father. He said, I'm not worthy to live in your house anymore. Let me be a hired servant. But the father said, no, my own who was lost has come back. And what's the symbolism of this? The prodigal son is our life force, that we're born with an awareness of the divine within us. But then we look at the theme park and we said, maybe it will be more fun to run around in circles and jump up and down and go high and low. And maybe I'll get that life force and I'll squander it. And where does that leave us? Down in the base chakras, eating from the leftovers of the pigs. It's not a pretty sight, is it? But that's what happens. And then all of a sudden we say, this isn't who I am. And we begin to draw the life force up again and return to God the Father. And when we get there, what's the rejoicing all about? It's the bliss of God when we withdraw the life force and bring it up again. And that's the inner meaning of that parable. So all of these scriptures are saying the same thing. And now we come to the science of the study of yoga. We come to Patanjali. There are two direct references to Kriya in Patanjali. One is, he calls it, Kriya consists of bodily discipline, concentration, and pranayama, controlling the life force, which, as we know, that's Kriya. And he also says, this highest achievement of samadhi can be attained, same as it says in the Gita, by when he calls it inspiration, is offered into the expiration, expiration offered to the inhalation. So they're all reflecting, go, do these techniques, reclaim your birthright, fight the Kauravas. None of them are saying, you know, this will happen by and by, just relax. They're saying, no, this is a battle. And the stakes are very high. We can be living as a hired workman in a foreign country, eating garbage, or we can reclaim our sense of nobility, of our soul nature. And they're all saying that. So now we come to Patanjali. And as Jyotish started the Eightfold Path, I'll pick up where he left off. But again, let's do it a little more experientially. I want you first to put down notes, sit up straight. You don't have to go to the bathroom. You've been doing that all along. Just relax and listen to bring your consciousness to the spiritual eye. Asana means to be seated in a firm, pleasant, and relaxed position. By reducing one's natural tendency toward restlessness and by visualizing infinity, true posture is acquired. From this point, the dualities cease to disturb the mind. The next stage in meditation is to calm the flow of the inner life force, pranayama. Okay, let's talk about these things a little bit. Open your eyes. Asana means to be seated in a firm, pleasant, relaxed position. It's what I'm going to do, and I've been doing this for myself to analyze every aspect of your practice of meditation. Don't take anything for granted. So you think, okay, I'm sitting down. All right, I did that. No, sitting down is not such an easy thing. We need to do it consciously. And so create a space that you know you'll be comfortable in, that is harmonious to you. And then Swami and Patanjali talk a great deal about the need to relax. So you can't meditate if you just run, you know, okay, sit down, I've been working all day, I'm going to meditate. It won't work. It's self-defeating. Even sitting is the beginning of meditation, asana. And so make sure that the place where you sit is comfortable. Check the body for tension. And then when you're comfortable, for example, for me, because I'm short, I have a cushion under my feet that I know will keep my knees parallel to the floor. I have a little cushion behind, I don't sit cross-legged, that I sit on, a little arc-shaped cushion. And I make sure that gives me just the leverage that keeps my spine upright. I tend to have tense shoulders, so I very consciously roll my shoulders back. And then it says, true asana is to be able to sit in that position for 3 hours. So when you sit, say, I need to be able to sustain this. If there's any part of me that's out of alignment, that's tense, let me work on that. And so to be able to sit that way, that's the beginning of meditation. And then it goes on to say, and when I read this, I thought, oh my God, because when I sit to meditate, my cheek itches. Oh, my hair's in my eyes. It said, without moving. And I realize how often I move. And look at the clock. It's time to get up. You know, just open your eyes, close your eyes, getting. And sometimes, I don't know if this happens to you, but I realize I do it. If I start going into a deep state of meditation, I'll open my eyes because I want to get oriented again. Just say, when I sit here, I'm not going to move. If I have to scratch my nose, it'll go away. If I have to get the hair out of my eyes, I can live with that. And I'm not going to open my eyes until this period of meditation is done. And so to really look at all these little aspects. Master says in autobiography, Jyotish was going to read this, but I realized that the breath and the restless mind were the storms which lashed the ocean of light into material forms. So the breath and the restless mind, this is what keeps us from being able to go deep. And you know, we can coast along for a whole lifetime thinking, okay, every morning I meditate, I do my hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it is. But we're speaking, as we said we would at the beginning of the class, to the deeper souls. We have to find ways to go deeper in meditation. Swami has said, there's no treading water on the spiritual path. You either are going backwards or forwards. So if you're at a plateau, that's not a plateau, it's going backwards. So is this to make us feel guilty? No. But it is to spur us on to look introspectively and say, where am I undermining myself? Restlessness, agitation, tension. Remember, I said Master talks about the power of relaxation. And is that power like tension, tense and relaxing? No. It's the power when we relax, all that energy that goes out to the body, the muscles, the everything, that energy all comes back. And we begin to feel the power of our own self. And I remember, so especially in Swami's last years, when he was in residence, he would often invite us over for tea at 5. And we'd go down, and very often, in fact, almost invariably, he would be sitting in the chair, which is still in his apartment, but he would have, it's a lazy boy, he would have the feet up. And we would walk in, and he would be in bliss. He would just, there would be an aura of light all around him, and often his eyes were closed. And I think really that's all. It wasn't about the tea or asking us what had happened that day. It was to give us darshan. And I wish I would have realized it, but I didn't at the time. But it was just the darshan of someone in deep absorption and bliss. So we'll go on. So we've talked about asana and pranayama. Pranayama is the controlling of the life force. So let's, again, go inward. And from this, I'm going to lead us in a guided meditation. So be ready to sit for 3 hours. The fifth state on the path of contemplation is known as pratyahara. Interiorization of the mind when the senses are withdrawn and the citta feeling is calm. Dharana is concentration, fixing one's full attention on one place, object, or idea at a time. Dhyana meditation is concentration on God or the higher aspects of reality, light, sound, love, wisdom, power, peace, calmness, bliss. When the subject and the object of his meditation become one, that is samadhi. So now I invite you to consciously relax the body. Feet, calves, knees, thighs, hip and buttocks, abdomen, stomach, hands and forearms, upper arms, chest, throat, jaw, face, eyes, brain. And let's watch our breath. And let's practice first inhaling with regular breath, inhaling to a count of 8 or 10 as is comfortable. Holding. Exhaling. We are calming the life force. Do this several times. Now take a deliberate breath, tense the body, and throw the breath out. And before we pick up the practice of Hong Sa, let's do a visualization that Master recommended to help us go deep in our own self. Imagine your body floating in space. Master said, visualize infinity moving out in front of you. Behind you. Infinity to the left. Infinity to the right. Above and below. Your bodiless self is floating in space. This visualization, Master teaches us, helps us to overcome the ups and downs. Duality. Now bring your attention to the breath, the inhalation and exhalation, and we'll do Hong Sa. But in his later teachings, years of his life, Swami instructed us of the importance in the Hong Sa practice not only of watching the breath, but of using the index finger of the right hand. As we inhale, let it move gently towards the palm. As we exhale, move away from the palm. The index finger represents the ego. With the inhalation, we're affirming self. With the exhalation, we're dissolving self. Swami says this was an important aspect of Hong Sa. So let's practice for a bit the Hong Sa technique, not letting your mind waver. Swami also said, enjoy the pauses as your breath becomes calm between the the inhalation and exhalation. So in a sense, it's a threefold experience, the inhalation, the exhalation, and the resting in the self without the storm of the restless mind and breath. So let's practice, continue, but enjoy the pause. And now, remember this feeling, and in your meditations moving forward, recall the power of relaxation and concentration. And as Patanjali says, concentration is fixed attention, but that's dharana, but dhyana is meditation on God. Is concentration on God or one of his aspects. So let's meditate now on the aspect of God as joy. And I'm going to read to you from Metaphysical Meditations, focusing at the spiritual eye. First feel, let go of every worry, concern, preoccupation, thought, and feel the joy of your own self. And Master says, if you have given up hope of ever being happy, cheer up. Never lose hope. Your soul being a reflection of the ever-joyous spirit is, in essence, happiness itself. If you keep the eyes of your concentration closed, you cannot see the sun of happiness burning within your bosom. But no matter how tightly you close the eyes of your attention, the fact nevertheless remains that the happiness rays are ever trying to pierce the closed doors of your mind. Open the windows of calmness and concentration, and you will find a sudden burst of the bright sun of joy within your very self. Feel the joy of your own self. Closing, I just want to share, we have dharana, dhyana, but what's the last stage? Samadhi. Don't push it away. Don't think this isn't for me. I thought that for many, many years. And then I came to realize it's not for me if I don't allow myself to enter into that country. And Patanjali says, when our flow of awareness becomes strong and steady, this upward flow becomes natural. As mental distractions dwindle and one's focus becomes more and more one-pointed, so one's inner identification with the samadhi state increases. Swami gave us the, opened the door, and he said, we should all walk through that door in this lifetime of becoming Jivan Muktas, freed while living. If we close the doors of our soul to that possibility, how will we ever walk through it? But if we say, with God's grace, I can find that state, each one of us, and together we can support each other in that quest. And so Patanjali is known even among the philosophers of India, his scripture, as the most powerful of all the scriptures, because it describes the how-to and the states that can be achieved. These aren't something that belongs to someone else. This is your birthright. It's my birthright. We only have to claim it and say, yes, I will do this. And may, through God's grace, we all achieve this state.